They have free will, just as men have. God created them free beings and gave them dignity. He has laid down laws to prevent them from corruption, which is for their benefit. Could any Muslim agree with this scandalous uncovering of women? The women of Iran have risen up against the Shah and delivered a punch to his mouth with the cry, "We don't want to be forced into immorality. We want to be free." As oil wealth and Western experts brought vices and the vilification of women to the Iranian society, the people rose up against the Pahlavi regime, joined by the country's Muslim women. It was a normal sight in the events leading to the victory of the Islamic Revolution to see thousands of devoted and dedicated women clad in black veils marching along men in the streets to protest the violation of rights by the Pahlavi regime. Thus, after the overthrow of the upstart Pahlavi regime, in accordance with the dynamic Sharia of Islam and the practical precedent set by the Ahl al-Bayt or Blessed Household of the Prophet, as was shown by Lady Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, Iranian women were freed from the shackles of Western-style corruption and created a worldwide impact for return to innate feminine values. Thanks to these liberating measures in Iran, Muslim women all over the world began to rediscover the freedom and virtues of the hijab, which was back in vogue. In Iran, women started participating in all spheres of life with a sense of honor and dignity. Gone were the days where publications of the regime ran columns against chastity and feminine virtues under direct orders of the U.S. and in blind aping of the decadent Western culture. Today, Iranian women enjoy all sorts of rights protected by the freedom of the hijab. As pointed out by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, this has annoyed the godless societies of the West, and in frustration, they accuse Iran of violating women's rights. They attack the dignity of the hijab and resort to preposterous lies by alleging that women are treated as second-class citizens in Iran. This is far from the truth. When we see Iranian women active in all spheres of society with their hijab intact and their determination to protect feminine dignity through their campaign for materializing the fruits of the Islamic Revolution.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamati, Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon
him, I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka choo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider.
Okay, and this is Asma. Thanks for having me here.
It's good to have you here, Sister Asma. It's fantastic.
Yes, and I'm very pleased to see you again.
Thank you. And yeah, we've worked together. We've discussed some really interesting things in a different show previously.
Yes,
but I believe this is the first time that we're together on Youth Station, which is really cool because Youth Station is where the fun's really at.
Yes, Youth Station is the favorite one. Before we start, I would love to ask you to pardon me because I have such a cacophonous voice today because I had a cold. So thank you for tolerating me.
So, okay, so we're talking about things to never do in a rush.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, as the first thing to talk about haste, well, everyone knows that haste is not a good thing. We should not do things in a rush, specifically important things and important decisions that we have to make in our lives. We have to give them a special attention and think about them instead of doing them in a rush.
Mm-hmm.
We have to take some very delicate notice that when you once you make a decision, there is no way to go back, and there might be some regrets. And that's why you have to care from the very first square.
But we live in a society, in a world today where, you know, we're surrounded by technology.
Yes.
And we all have very, very busy schedules. Wake up, go to work, you know, you're
exactly.
standing in traffic, and then you've got to rush to do this, you've got to rush to do the groceries, rush, rush, rush. I find a lot of the time my life is just rushing to get things done, you know, the checklist.
Yes, of course, but not for important things in life that you have to give them a special care and thoughts.
What do you mean by important things?
For example, going into a relationship, you can't do that in a rush. You should give it a second thought, perhaps a third thought.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes a relationship that you are getting into, that you're jumping into it, is not exactly the thing that is good for you. Maybe the people you are trying to bring into your close circle are not exactly the people you have to be with.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have to really think twice before you take an action.
Right. But I think we need to go for a break right now. So we're going to go for a quick break. You can rejoin us after the break, inshallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
In terms of friendship, you know, you meet somebody and
yes.
then, you know, you get to know each other. And, you know, like, for example, my family, we recently met this really cool family and we like them. And, you know, they pray their salah on time and everything and, you know, all the usual stuff.
Yes.
And so we kind of rushed to invite them to our house for ourselves to be invited to their house. And then.
Yes,
you know,
that's about communication. You know,
uh-huh.
the communications do not have to be that very much delicate. I mean, you don't have to think about those things. Those are not very, very important things and life-changing decisions to make when you are going to meet someone. But when you are going to allow them into your very close circle,
uh-huh.
when you are going to bring them nearer to your life, that's where you exactly have to think twice.
Okay.
Giving people chances to get into your life or in giving yourself the right to get into a relationship where you are not very much sure of the decisions you're making or of the people you are
mm-hmm.
entering into your life, that's where you have to think.
Okay. What else should we not rush in? I know one thing.
What?
That we often, it's just become a standard part of modern lifestyle. Food, mealtimes.
Yes, exactly.
We end up rushing mealtimes all the time. I mean,
we should give our brain a time to digest
and know
that we're eating. We don't have to eat more.
I'm really quite surprised because according to the Islamic literature and the ahadith that we have, you're supposed to give food its due care, attention, and time. You
exactly.
know, take as there's even a hadith that says that as much time as you want to spend on the dinner table, you should go ahead and spend it because that amount of time will never be detracted from your overall lifespan.
Yes, that's true.
You know, so the overall sentiment here, according to the ahadith, is that, you know, you should give time to your food.
Yes,
now that
exactly.
dinner time, that meal time, that breakfast time, to actually be like
yes, we shouldn't be in a rush for every single thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also the hadith about, you know, you should chew your food like 40 times.
Yes. But there's no deny that is sometimes you cannot really miss the rushing. Sometimes you have to be in a rush.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not in that rush, then you're going to miss a lot of fun. The life would lose its adventure. Its adventurous parts and aspects.
Like, what do you mean?
Like, for example, there's some special times in your life where you are invited to some ceremonies or, like, into some new jobs, into some good things, I mean.
Uh-huh.
Some good things are not the cases for us to give them a time or...
But couldn't you argue that even in those cases, like, let's say you have a really important interview to get to or something,
yes,
you still shouldn't rush, because rushing your food, and yes, I'm a hypocrite for saying this because I do rush my food, but rushing your food has loads of repercussions on your health and on your attitude. Like, you know, if you don't chew your food properly, it's going to be really bad for your digestion, then you're going to be gassy, and then you're going to have this problem. So even if you do turn up at the interview, you know, you're not going to be fully settled.
Yes.
Even that amount of food that you have eaten, it's not going to be digested properly. What is it? The scientists of the nutrition and digestive system were saying, and they said that, look, we've actually forgotten as human beings how we're supposed to chew our food. We're actually supposed to liquefy our food in our mouths before we swallow it.
Because it's good for your health.
Yeah, but we don't. You know, you give it two chews and then you just swallow
it. And in the end, you're not going to regret the day you've spent eating that dinner or lunch. Because then when the overweight comes, then you're not enjoying the food you have eaten.
Okay, so that's two things that we've talked about. That's getting into relationships with people and eating.
Yes.
What other things should we not rush?
Well,
crossing
jumping off a cliff.
Suicide?
Suicide.
Yeah, you shouldn't rush into that. Like, think about it 10 times, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah. That's very dangerous.
Exactly.
Dangerous things.
See, nobody really rushes into suicide. They always think about it and think about it and think about it.
Yes, they think about it. And when they're fed up, they do that. Totally, as a general point, we could say that in Islam, we are not advised to rush into things.
Mm-hmm.
But for good things, to do some good jobs, you are recommended to rush into the good things you're going to do. For example, you're going to help your sister or your brother, then there's no way for you to waste your time on hesitating or thinking too much.
That is a really good point. We've been discussing about things that you shouldn't rush according to Islam. And we talked about, number one, not getting it, rushing into relationships.
Yes,
number two,
exactly,
not rushing into food. Then we talked about suicide for some reason. But that was just kind of a tangent. Things that you should rush.
Yes, exactly.
Oftentimes, one of the problems, sisters, is that when somebody hears a hadith about, like, for example, this, like, for example, that you shouldn't rush things, they take everything very slowly, everything in their lives. And then, you know,
the opportunities are missed.
Yeah, opportunities are missed.
You lose the time.
You end up annoying people as well because you're talking really, really slowly.
Well, based on some personal experience, I would say that too much thinking also is not good. When we say we don't have to rush into things, we don't mean that we have to take a very long time of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
A prolonged time of thinking would not allow you to go forward and do things that you have to do, you must do, and you have to take a very quick action towards them. Generally, we have to take that moderation key in our head always on, because that's the important part of the story. We have to be moderate, no matter if it's a decision, if it's a job we're going to take part in. We have to be moderate, I think.
Yeah.
Think about it, but don't be so...
hesitant.
Hesitant, yeah.
Like Hamlet. The Hamlet character, Hamlet is, you know, to be or not to be, that famous Shakespearean character. He's always thinking, should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? Shouldn't I do it? And then it makes him so indecisive that you, as the audience, actually get frustrated by his, you know, inability to make a decision.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you don't be Hamlet.
So we're not with precipitous plans, but also we're not with thinking too much, overthinking in a way that you'll lose all the opportunities and the chances you have in front of you.
Yeah, the Quran says, وَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. When you make a decision, trust in Allah after that. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, you've got to make your decision, even if it is a life-changing decision. But you're right. Good things should be rushed
or
into.
Or not to be waiting.
Which dua is it? Where I think it's... Is it Dua Kumail or is it one of the other duas? I think it's from Sahifa Sajjadiyah, where it actually says that two things have caused me to sin, basically. And that one of the things was rushing towards that thing which you have forbidden, oh Allah. And hesitating in front of that thing that you have commanded.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So this, I believe, would play into the idea of that moderation. You need to rush towards good things. And, you know, the salah as well. You know,
Hayya
ala khayri al-amal. Rush towards the best of deeds.
Yes,
right? So
the best deeds are not to be waiting. You have to do them very quickly.
And actually, this is actually a problem that I feel. I don't know if you've experienced this, Sister Asma, but have you seen Lord of the Rings?
Yes, of course I have seen. Because
you like Lord of the Rings? You like Lord of the Rings? Lord of the Rings is so cool.
Lord of the Ring is good.
It's so cool. Yes. But do you remember Treebeard?
Yes.
The big tree character, right?
Yes.
We ants don't say anything unless it's worth taking a long time to say.
Yes.
Right? Yes. So they start talking like that.
No, being a religious, just coming back to what you just mentioned, being religious doesn't mean you act like an old person, but that really means being a real human being who thinks carefully and does things in...
rationally, intellectually.
Yes, rationally,
right.
Yes, because it's a religion of rationalism, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Islam
you
is a supremely intellectual religion.
You think and you do things based on what you have thought about.
Absolutely, yeah. There are certain hadith that say that, you know, you should look at the elders and try to imitate them. The question here, though, is what things should you try to imitate them in?
Because they're wiser. They experienced more things, and we have to learn from those experiences.
But that doesn't mean that you need to behave like them.
No. You can be young and still acting wisely.
Speaking about rushing, we've actually run out of time.
Yes.
So that's all we have time for today. We've talked about some of the things that we should rush in, some of the things that we should not rush
in. There's no blessing in haste, but sometimes you have to be quick when you're doing some good things.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all we have time for from myself and from Sister Asma. We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness, I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. For the first time, the Pentagon has declassified and publicly released footage of the U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. It was one of the U.S. military's final acts in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year-long military intervention in the country. The videos show the scene of the strike before, during, and after a missile struck a civilian car in a courtyard on August 29th in Kabul. Indistinct images show individuals moving in or near the attack zone. The Pentagon initially defended the attack, claiming it had targeted an operative of Daesh terrorist group. But in November, the Pentagon acknowledged it had committed a tragic mistake. Instead of terminating a terrorist, the U.S. military had killed a civilian and 9 members of his family. 3 months later, the department announced no one would be held accountable for the brutal carnage. Critics believe such reports failed to address the systematic problems in U.S. conduct of drone warfare, making future civilian casualties inevitable. Now, many Afghans, including the victims' relatives, want the Kabul strike to be regarded as a war crime. Afghans say the U.S. military had acknowledged such strikes as mistakes in the past, but their perpetrators were never brought to justice. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drones and airstrikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have also accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them.
Now, if you're talking about rules of war, the traditional understanding of the just war, the Geneva Conventions, any of these things, you cannot deliberately target a civilian population. That's a war crime if you do that. But it became the tradition because of World War II. And because the United States won World War II, then they could establish this as a kind of right.
Despite the shambolic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, the Biden administration has said it will continue to use aerial attacks, including drone raids, to deal with security threats in the country and counter Daesh terrorists. However, the killing of innocent civilians in Kabul raised questions about the future of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan. Now, advocates have decried the U.S. administration's stated plan. The African-American advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow has urged an end to all U.S. drone strikes in the country, saying it's a failed policy that harms lives, destroys villages, and only allows for more violence to exist in Afghanistan. That's while the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. According to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars, the U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000.
The strategy of attacking civilians was established then. It's immoral. It's clearly immoral, but they've been doing it for 70 years now. And where do you draw the line? How do you say, oh, beginning in 1972, it became immoral? No, it's the whole tradition of air warfare is by its the way it's been executed here has been immoral from the beginning.
The high number of civilian casualties in U.S. airstrikes in various theaters calls under question the authenticity of Washington's claims of fighting terrorists and its intelligence precision. In late December, leaked Pentagon documents show that the U.S. air wars in West Asia have been marked by flawed intelligence, faulty targeting, years of civilian deaths, and scant accountability. This has further fueled the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after 2 decades of war.
Iran, Russia, and China began joint military drills in the north of the Indian Ocean on Friday. Dubbed the 2022 Marine Security Belt, the exercises are the third to have been carried out between the three countries. The drills cover 17,000 square kilometers of ocean. Vessels and equipment from both Iran's army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were on maneuvers. A variety of tactical exercises, such as rescuing burning vessels, releasing hijacked vessels, shooting at specific targets, shooting at air targets at night, and other tactical and operational exercises were carried out during the drills. Strengthening the security of the international maritime trade, combating piracy and maritime terrorism, exchanging intelligence in the field of maritime rescue missions, and exchanging operational and technical experience were among the objectives of the 2022 Marine Security Belt exercise.
So I believe that the message is mostly to the people and to the nation, like the United States or other allies, that they want to have, they want to carry on some kind of activities in these areas. And if you ask me if this one is something where it will create a kind of joint action between Iran, Russia, and China, I would say yes, in this area. I don't think that they will tolerate in the future any kind of activities that we can define as terrorist or attack or pirates or these kind of things.
Iran says its presence in the international coalitions manifests the improvement of the Islamic Republic's standing in the world. An Iranian spokesman for the joint drills says Tehran attaches great importance to the establishment of security at regional and international levels. The trilateral exercises come as Iran is taking steps to balance its foreign policy. While talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and the removal of U.S. sanctions against Iran are underway in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Tehran is expanding its ties with its two key allies, Russia and China. Earlier this month, Iran and China began the implementation of much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact, known as the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, a 25-year cooperation agreement that's aimed at strengthening the two countries' economic and political ties. Also last week, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Tehran and Moscow are set to begin working on drawing up a similar roadmap that will shape their cooperation for the next two decades. The statement came as Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was on a two-day trip to Russia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization's unanimous decision last September to approve Iran's membership to the bloc after almost 15 years was yet another development signaling the future of Iran's economic and political ties with the East.
I think that the strategy of the geopolitics of the United States is in this area, and I will say basically in Eurasia, is in the way that they don't want the formation of a strong Eurasian continent. So, they're fighting basically against China and very strong against the Russia, and they have first the sanction with Iran, and they put a lot of pressure to Iran. So it's normal that these three countries, they will join together from a different point of view.
What this all shows is that Iran is seeking a more balanced foreign policy and that Tehran isn't staking its future entirely on the fate of the 2015 deal anymore. While making efforts to salvage a deal, it's considering other options to ensure its economic goals are met.
On Monday, Yemen's military launched retaliatory attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates using drones and missiles to strike strategic targets in the UAE. Yemeni forces targeted a strategic oil facility and a fire at Abu Dhabi's international airport. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks against targets in Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen. But attacks against the UAE, which is fighting alongside Saudi Arabia, has been rare. It's widely believed that the attacks made UAE officials realize their vulnerabilities. The attacks are the greatest damage to the reputation of the UAE because they have always portrayed themselves as a safe and secure country to do business. Yemeni officials have warned they could target more facilities in the UAE. The years-long war on Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and pushed the country towards humanitarian catastrophe. Following the retaliatory strikes, Israel offered security and intelligence support to the United Arab Emirates. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said the regime is committed to working closely with the UAE against Yemeni forces. He also ordered the Israeli establishment to provide their counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Since joining the Saudi-led coalition in the invasion of Yemen, the UAE has focused on the southern and coastal regions of Yemen. It's also trying to take control of its strategic and resource-rich ports and islands in that region. Socotra is strategically located at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, overlooking the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the Red Sea to both the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. The UAE is annexing the island with the help of the Israeli regime. The UAE is said to be setting up an espionage center for Israel at the Socotra airport in Yemen.
This is not the case. Israel has no business interfering in Yemen any more than Saudi Arabia or the United States do, or the UAE. But by this recent action, which is people of Yemen simply defending their country and opposing one of the other countries that is causing significant, extreme problems within Yemen.
Al Hilal Emirates Company is said to have signed a contract with Israel to build a spy and intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at the airport in the city of Hadibo, the center of the Socotra Island. In December of 2021, Bennett became the first leader of the Israeli regime to visit the Persian Gulf state, more than a year after the two sides agreed to establish formal relations under a U.S. brokered deal.
Israel would like to see this as a false flag, would like to convince the United States government and the people of the United States that it must attack Iran because Iran has attacked one of its allies and poses a threat to the existence of Israel. Anything that anyone says or does Israel doesn't like, it considers what it calls an existential threat to Israel.
The UAE officially inaugurated its embassy in Israel in July last year, and then Israel opened its embassy in the Emirati capital in late June. Since they signed a normalization agreement in August last year, Israel and the UAE have signed a raft of deals in various areas, ranging from tourism to aviation and financial services.
Look to the east, the current Iranian administration says that is the policy it is implementing. Tehran prioritizes expanding ties with neighboring and other regional countries. This largely forms the basis of Iran's foreign policy and its deepening ties with eastern powers like China and Russia. The Iranian president's high-profile two-day visit to Russia this week has been widely described as a turning point in relations between Tehran and Moscow. Ebrahim Raisi, who arrived in the Russian capital on Wednesday, sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The two presidents' discussions lasted 3 hours. Bilateral cooperation in the fields of infrastructure, energy, banking, and trade was the main focus of the talks. Putin praised the two neighbors' close cooperation on the international stage. The two presidents tasked Russian and Iranian foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next 2 decades. President Raisi said the two neighbors will soon finalize their 20-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. During their meeting on Wednesday, Putin and Raisi condemned unilateralism and stressed the need to confront it. The meeting came as both Iran and Russia are locked in disputes with the United States, which both Tehran and Moscow have condemned for unending unilateralism. Tehran has been targeted by many rounds of unilateral American sanctions, and Russia, already under American sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, is now being threatened again by Washington as tensions over Ukraine run high.
Both Russia and Iran are being subject to the same kind of pressures coming out of Washington by the Biden administration, which is trying to reassert the U.S. hegemony over world politics. They're living in the past. The past has long gone past them by, but they haven't realized it yet, and they're trying to use the power of the so-called Western Alliance, which today is very much divided in many respects, to pressure countries like Russia, like Iran, like China.
In an address to Russia's lower house of parliament, Duma, on Thursday, the Iranian president said sanctions are a common form of bullying and domination. He added that fighting the sanctions requires a collective response and cooperation among independent nations. Some observers believe that American sanctions have persuaded targeted nations like Iran, Russia, and China to work together more closely. Meanwhile, Raisi also warned that the United States has forged a satanic alliance with the terrorists. He said complicated plans are afoot now to send the terrorists on a new mission to the Caucasus in Central Asia. Russia and Iran have a history of cooperation in the fight against terrorism in the region, especially in Syria. And observers believe they could act together again if necessary. The Islamic Republic seems to be very serious about its look to the East policy. Becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September last year is considered a major step in that direction. Also, Iran and China's 25-year strategic cooperation agreement, which the two sides began implementing a few days ago, is another major sign that Tehran wants to enhance relations and exchanges with Asian powers.
That's really where the future is. You're going to see probably a revival of what used to be the ancient Silk Road now, with China's Belt and Road Initiative, which now Iran's going to be a part of. And that may, again, put that whole region in the center of economic development to the demise or the lower position by the Europeans and the Americans.
Iran says it is open to more partnerships that benefit both sides and are based on mutual respect.
In the limelight.
In Washington State and Texas, one study found 42% of child care workers experienced food insecurity, with 20% of child care workers experiencing very high food insecurity. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Colin Page, McKinn's journalist. This article is published under the heading, Around 1 in 3 Childcare Workers Are Going Hungry in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. Of the nearly 1 million child care workers in the United States of America, in a recent white paper, 31.2%, basically one out of every three, experienced food insecurity in 2020, the latest year for which experts analyzed data recently. Food insecurity means there is a lack of consistent access to enough food. This rate of food insecurity is anywhere from 8 to 20%, points higher than the national average. In Washington State and Texas, one study found 42% of childcare workers experienced food insecurity, with 20% of childcare workers experiencing very high food insecurity. High food insecurity is when a person reports reduced quality and variety of diet. Very high food insecurity occurs when a person reports disrupted eating patterns and reduced food intake. Another study in Arkansas found that 40% of childcare workers experience food insecurity. People who are food insecure are at increased chances of being poor health, with conditions like hypertension, diabetes, asthma, arthritis, and depression, among other chronic diseases and health conditions. Low wages and food insecurity may contribute to child care workers' high stress levels. When child care workers experience stress, they tend to reduce the amount of positive attention to children and increase their punitive responses to children's challenging behavior. Overall, child care workers' wages are low, with the median hourly wage being $12.24 per hour. This means child care workers make little more than fast food workers, whose median pay is $11.64 per hour. What child care workers make is not considered a living wage. As a result of low wages, more than 53% of child care workers received public assistance, including Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program from 2014 to 2016. This compares with the 21% of elementary and middle school teachers who received public assistance in that period. When so many child care workers rely on public assistance, it reveals how many of them don't make enough money to get by. Nearly all U.S. child care workers are women, and half are people of color. This workforce is central to providing high-quality early childhood education to children up to 5 years old. Early childhood researchers and policymakers have focused on increasing the education and training of the child care workforce to bolster quality. The Center for the Study of Child Care Employment recommends that lead teachers, the primary teachers in the early childhood classrooms who are responsible for day-to-day management of a classroom, at least have a bachelor's degree, and that assistant teachers at least have a child development associate certificate or equivalent. Despite the fact that the more education child care workers have, the higher quality care they deliver, many states require only a high school diploma or equivalent, and some states do not have any education requirements for entry-level positions. On average, child care workers who have a bachelor's degree to make more than those who don't. However, going to college doesn't pay off as much for child care workers as it does for those in other fields. Child care workers with a bachelor's degree average $14.70 per hour, which is just under half the average earnings overall of those with a bachelor's degree, $27 per hour.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from latter's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
In the important event related to the Gohar Shad Mosque, the leaders were the late Haj Agha Hossein Qumi, may God bestow paradise on him, and the scholars in Mashhad. In the 30th of Tir uprising, the leader was the late Ayatollah Kashani, and in the 15th of Khordad uprising, the leader was our magnanimous Imam and a number of other great religious scholars. In all of these events, a courageous revolutionary political cleric was present, and it was his presence that was the foundation of a popular movement. Of course, some influential people may have been able to make a certain number of people respond to something and urge them to make a move, but moving the majority of the people forward and creating waves in a great ocean has only been something a religious scholar or cleric could do. It is based on this that we can understand the secret behind the enmity of the arrogant powers in the world towards religious scholars, political religion, political jurisprudence, and political intellectuals. Their enmity originates from the fact that such people were anti-arrogant and anti-colonialist, and they were the initiators behind these great events.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemies were aware of this, and that is why they are opposed to the political scholars, political religious authorities, and political jurisprudence. They explicitly say that they are hostile towards political religion and political Islam. This is a reality that we should pay attention to. Moreover, the deep enmity and grudge the US holds towards the Islamic Republic of Iran can be understood from this matter as well. The Islamic Republic is the embodiment of the people's religious beliefs, and it originates from a revolutionary religious outlook towards the current issues in the world and in the country. Hence, the leader of the arrogant powers, the US, is opposed to the Islamic Republic. Some people say, why are you opposed to the US? Why do you say death to America? In my opinion, this is a naive, shallow comment. The essence of the matter is that the nature of arrogance is such that it is opposed to a phenomenon called the Islamic Republic, which is completely indebted to religion and which originates from a religious movement and from religious scholars. This is one point about the 9th of January.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation.
That was how Joe Biden laid out the path for his presidency during his inaugural address on the 6th of January, 2021. It came after supporters of his predecessor Donald Trump raided the Capitol Hill in a deadly unrest because the former president refused to accept defeat and claimed an election fraud. Speaking exactly a year after he took office, Biden said he had not overpromised in his inaugural speech on what he could achieve. Yet a review of the status quo in the United States tells a different story. Back in October, a poll showed that 41% of Biden's supporters and 52% of those who voted for Trump want Republican and Democratic-led states to secede and form two new countries. The divide continues to define the American society and politics to the day. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate blocked Biden's key legislation to protect voting rights for African Americans and other minorities, especially in the Republican-controlled states. Democrats pushed the legislation amid restrictive voting in some Republican-led states, which Democrats see as a slow-motion coup to retake the White House in the next presidential election. Republican-led states also moved to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. That's teaching students on the history of slavery and racism and how they shaped U.S. institutions and policy to ensure the dominance of white people. One such ban did actually become law in Mississippi on Saturday. The debates hark back to racial tensions triggered by the fatal shootings of African Americans, which have ignited some of the most serious social unrest of the modern times in the U.S. A case in point in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in November. The not guilty verdict in the trial was an affront to those who saw the teenager as a murderer, butting into a protest against racial injustice and killing two demonstrators. The ruling, however, was a gift to those who saw Rittenhouse as a right-wing patriot. Over the past year, the U.S. has also seen huge divisions among Republican and Democratic voters over such issues as the conservative-led push to restrict constitutional abortion rights, obligatory vaccination against the coronavirus, and even Democratic-led attempts to curb access to guns. These have also been key areas of political point scoring among Republicans and Democrats.
One thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for?
Deep divides have always been there among Democrats and Republicans and their supporters, but the Capitol Hill insurrection seems to have radicalized things. Trump continues to enjoy backing from Republicans after he triggered the insurrection by the claim that Biden won the election by vote rigging. This has polarized American politics more than ever before. The insurrection has also sent reverberations through the American society, dividing people across political and racial lines.
Things started out peacefully on Sunday as an estimated 50,000 protesters took to the streets of Brussels in opposition to COVID-19 vaccines and the requirement to show certificates in order, for example, to eat in a restaurant or travel. However, things turned ugly as police were attacked by some of the demonstrators. Tear gas and water cannon were then deployed to break up the crowds. Prior to the clashes, we spoke to some of those in attendance.
Do you think the vaccine is dangerous?
I'm sure that it is dangerous.
There's no problem with the vaccine. If you want a vaccine, okay. But if you don't want it, please leave us be.
The European United Group, which organized the event, claims it's not anti-vax, but it certainly didn't sound that way.
To Mr. Bill Gates, we say, you might mean well with your vaccines, but we don't need them.
The data is indisputable. Lockdowns followed by vaccines, when they became available, are measures that have saved millions of lives. But some insist the inoculation drive is going too far.
Children shouldn't be vaccinated. We have an immune system. We shouldn't do this. This is an experiment.
For others, the booster campaign is an issue.
I had my basic vaccines because I work in healthcare. But booster after booster, it's not okay.
The 27-nation EU has a population of just under 450 million. 20% of adults are refusing to take a COVID-19 vaccine.
That is clearly a very significant minority. Epidemiologists say if they did take the jab, most of the restrictions these people are protesting against could be lifted much more quickly.
Anarchists managed to reach the offices of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Police are promising arrests in the coming days. The protesters are promising they will be back out on the streets here again next Sunday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.